My last day here for the week, so have a lot of ground to cover. Any questions left over from what we've been talking about the last few days here? We kind of left off with a passage or a section that a lot of people use to say that Jesus has done away with any distinctions between clean and unclean meats, and as we'll see, that is not the case. So we'll pick up the story here, Matthew 15, verses 7 through 9 and 12 through 14. Jesus says, addressing those who are criticizing his disciples for eating with ceremonially unwashed hands, and he says, "Hypocrites, well did Isaiah prophesy about you, saying, 'These people draw near to me with their mouth and honor me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. And in vain they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men.'" And as we commented yesterday, a lot of what traditional Christianity today is the traditions of men that have been elevated above what the Bible actually says. So they don't follow the commandments of God, but instead teaches doctrines, the commandments of men. And I really love this next section here. Yeah, verse 12, "Then his disciples came and said to him, 'Do you know that the Pharisees were offended when they heard this saying?' But Jesus answered and said, 'Every plant which my Father, Heavenly Father, is not planted will be uprooted. Let them alone,'" referring to the Pharisees. "They are blind leaders of the blind. And if the blind leads the blind, both will fall into the ditch." Okay, continuing with Mark 7, verse 17. "When he had entered a house away from the..." Sorry, this is Mark. Sorry, I was working on this late last night and wasn't entirely with it. Okay, Mark 7, verse 17. "When he had entered a house away from the crowd, his disciples asked him concerning the parable," or in this case, it's not really a parable, but what he had just explained about this illustration that he had used, what he meant when he said that it isn't what goes into a man that defiles him. So Jesus explains then, and goes into more, gives the explanation for what he said here. And this is the real lesson here for us. Verse 18, "So Jesus said to them, 'Are you thus without understanding also? Do you not perceive that whatever enters a man from outside cannot defile him, because it does not enter his heart, but his stomach, and is eliminated, thus purifying all foods?'" Here, this is a section that many people use to argue that nothing is unclean anymore, that Jesus purified all food, said that we can eat anything. But that's really not what he is saying at all, because again, what is the context? The context is about ceremonially washed hands. It's not about clean and unclean meats. As we saw in one of the parables yesterday about the fish, that the fishermen gather them up and they put the good fish into storage containers and they throw the bad away. Why would Jesus turn right around then and declare all types of food clean? So just does not make any sense. What Jesus is really saying here, and it's obvious from the context, is that he says it does not enter his heart but his stomach. And what he's saying here is that the digestive process will take care of whatever food, whatever dirt might be in the food. In other words, the digestive system has bacteria in there that will break that down, and in many cases will take care of toxic items there. And the dirt doesn't go into the heart, but it goes into the digestive tract and then out through the bowels there. And that process does not make a person unclean. Simply the natural processes working the way that God designed them to do with our digestive tracts to kill off any nasty stuff that might be in any dirt that might be on the food or on our hands. And then Jesus explains in more detail his point in verse 20. And he said, "What comes out of a man, that is what defiles a man. For from within, out of the heart of men, proceed evil thoughts, adulteries, fornications, murders, thefts, covetousness, wickedness, deceit, lewdness, an evil eye, blasphemy, pride, foolishness. All these evil things come from within and defile a man." So again, it's not a matter of ceremonial washing and cleansing of hands, but is what is inside that really defiles a person. And of course, what were the Pharisees guilty of? A lot of the same exact things here. Theft, covetousness, deceit, pride, foolishness, blasphemy. Those were very characteristic of their mindset that we've talked about a number of different times here. Now we come to an interesting section. As I've discussed before, so much of Jesus Christ's ministry takes place in this little area around Galilee, northern part of the Sea of Galilee, Capernaum, Bethsaida, and Chorazin. But now Jesus does something quite interesting. He withdraws and goes to a very different area, to the region of Tyre and Sidon. And here's where these are for our reference. Here's Sea of Galilee, here's Capernaum. Notice where Tyre is. Tyre is way up here on the in what is today modern-day Lebanon. Sidon is actually even further north from that. So this is an area about 40 miles as the crow flies and at least several days' walk from Galilee. Why do they go there? No explanation is given. These are Gentile areas as well. This is well outside of the Jewish areas there. Perhaps thinking is that what is going on here, as we'll see throughout what we cover today, is that things are heating up a lot there in Galilee. The atmosphere is getting very hostile to him. He knows the time is drawing closer and closer for him to die. And so he is either going away to another area to escape some of the danger, or perhaps, again, as we covered yesterday, so many people are following him that he just can't get away and have any time to himself. So maybe he just goes far away where he knows people are not going to follow him this far into a Gentile area. So let's pick it up and see what happens there. Then Jesus went out from there, from Galilee, and departed to the region of Tyre and Sidon. And behold, a woman of Canaan, so she's a Gentile, came from that region and cried out to him, saying, "Have mercy on me, O Lord, Son of David. My daughter is severely demon-possessed." But he answered her not a word. And his disciples came and urged him, saying, "Send her away, for she cries out after us." But he answered and said, "I was not sent except to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." So Jesus says his mission at that time was to go to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, not to the Gentiles. The preaching of the gospel to the Gentiles will come later by whom? Who was commissioned to go to the Gentiles? Paul, the Apostle Paul is. Continuing, verse 25, "Then she came and worshipped him, saying, 'Lord, help me.'" And again, this word worship more typically means bowed down as a sign of honor and respect, not necessarily that she is literally worshiping him. So keep that in mind when you come across that word. "So she came and worshipped him, saying, 'Lord, help me.' But he answered and said, 'It is not good to take the children's bread and throw it to the little dogs.' And she said, 'Yes, Lord, yet even the little dogs eat the crumbs which fall from their master's table.' Then Jesus answered and said to her, 'O woman, great is your faith. Let it be to you as you desire.' And her daughter was healed from that very hour." A couple of things to think about here. First of all, it's interesting what this shows, that Jesus did not intend to heal the woman's daughter. Or that seems to be what is going on the surface. Another way to look at this is perhaps, we know he does this at times, will test people's faith and see just how strong that faith, that belief is, whether she would be persistent. So initially, maybe what's going on initially is he puts her off just to see what her response is going to be. But the woman, by her faith, convinced Jesus to do it anyway. He changes his mind and heals the daughter and praises her faith. And as we talked about with the Roman centurion yesterday, here is a Gentile, and Jesus holds him up as a great example of faith. And we see here, this is a Gentile woman, and he holds her up as a great example of faith as well. Another thing to consider here is this tells me that not every little detail Christ's life is planned out. For instance, as we covered a number of weeks ago, the woman at the well in Samaria, where Jesus is passing through Samaria, has this chance encounter with this woman at the well and ends up staying there several days. And here we have a case where Jesus encounters this woman and initially says he's not going to heal her daughter and then changes his mind and does. So this tells us that Christ's life isn't planned out to every last detail, that he can, and at times does change his mind due to other influences. Emily, did you have a question back there?
Yeah, I guess I'm not sure if I'm understanding the metaphor that's presented here.
Uh-huh. Oh, about the little dogs?
Yeah.
Yeah, it sounds more harsh than it is there. I've read that. I don't recall the details about it.
She's Gentile, like, and he's saying, don't give stuff to people who aren't going to appreciate it, I guess. And she was saying, like, well, even someone like me will still appreciate something like this. Is that kind of what it is?
Essentially so. The children's bread, clearly what he's talking about there are the Israelites as God's children, or the Jewish people as God's children. So that's where the children's bread comes in. Don't take something that the Israelites, the Jewish people there, are promised and give it to the dogs. That was a pretty common metaphor among the Jews of that day to refer to the Gentiles as dogs and unclean and that kind of thing. But yeah, it's interesting. The woman just flips that around and says, well, even the dogs get to eat some of the crumbs from the master's table, referring to the Jews. Yes, Charlie, you had a comment or thought on
that? Margin here mentioned that little dogs is a diminutive used as a term of endearment, typically referred to house dogs that slept in the master's lap. So it seems like it's she's saying, like, even though the little dogs eat the crumbs off the floor, helping out me as a Gentile, even though I know that your prerogative is the Jews, mm-hmm. it won't take away from your work with the Jews. Just like my daughter yeah. won't go hungry because the dog's getting a few crumbs off the floor.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's a good explanation. Yeah, I could see that. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Yeah, sorry, I didn't go into this and research it more, but yeah, good thoughts. Appreciate that. Okay, continuing on in Mark's account. Mark 7, verse 31, beginning there. So Jesus leaves then the coastal area of Tyre and Sidon and then goes through interesting circles around and goes to the pagan area of the Decapolis, which again is over on the east side of the Sea of Galilee. So then we pick up the story. Again, departing from the region of Tyre and Sidon, he came through the midst of the region of Decapolis to the Sea of Galilee. So he seems to be in a Gentile area at this point. Then they brought to him one who was deaf and had an impediment in his speech, and they begged Jesus to put his hand on him. And Jesus took him aside from the multitude and put his fingers in his ears, and he spat and touched his tongue. Then looking up to heaven, he sighed and said to him, Ephphatha, which that is, be opened. And immediately his ears were opened, and the impediment of his tongue was loosed, and he spoke plainly. Then Jesus commanded them that they should tell no one. So again, this is happening multiple times now where he tells people he's healed not to spread this around. But the more he commanded them, the more widely they proclaimed it. That's rather interesting. The more he tells them don't do this, they go out and do it anyway and spread the word. And they were astonished beyond measure, saying, he has done all things well. He makes both the deaf to hear and the mute to speak. So again, this is in a Gentile area. Apparently this individual is a Gentile. And then follows another great miracle among the Gentiles, which is a repeat of the miracle of multiplying food to feed a large number of people. So Mark 8 and verse 1. In those days, the multitude being very great and having nothing to eat, Jesus called his disciples to him and said to them, I have compassion on the multitude. And that's a theme we talked about and saw a number of times in yesterday's classes. where Jesus recognizes human need and performs miracles to fulfill that need. We talked about his compassion for the little girl, the daughter of the ruler of the synagogue, who he notices the girl is hungry after he's raised her back to life and tells people to get her some food to eat. And as we saw with the previous multiplying of the loaves of bread and the fishes, Jesus felt compassion. So that is certainly a characteristic of our master and rabbi that we should be developing. It is a reflection of the nature of God. He says, I have compassion on the multitude because they have now continued with me 3 days and have nothing to eat. And if I send them away hungry to their own houses, they will faint on the way, for some of them have come from afar. So again, he truly cares about people. He is healing, he is teaching, but he also notices something, that these people have been following him for several days and listening to his teaching. So what does he do? Continuing, verse 4, then his disciples answered him, how can one satisfy these people with bread here in the wilderness? And again, wilderness, this just means an uninhabited area. It's one of these open areas between some of the towns and villages there. It's not necessarily talking about a desert or that kind of thing. Sometimes it does. The word can mean that, but here it's just talking about the area between the villages there. So Jesus asked them, verse 5, how many loaves do you have? And they said, 7. So he commanded the multitude to sit down on the ground. And he took the 7 loaves and gave thanks, broke them, and gave them to his disciples to set before them. And they set them before the multitude. They also had a few small fish, and having blessed them, he said to set them also before them. So they ate and were filled, and they took up 7 large baskets of leftover fragments. Now those who had eaten were about 4,000, and he sent them away. So again, dramatic, powerful miracle. The first one takes place, the first miracle we talked about yesterday took place near Bethsaida. This apparently takes place somewhere in the region of the Decapolis with Gentiles here. So let's continue on. Let's see. Now the section about Pharisees and Sadducees seeking a miraculous sign. I'll just skip over that because it is very similar to material that we've already covered. Here again, he mentions the sign of the prophet Jonah, which we've talked about, the 3 days and the 3 nights. We'll also skip over the next part about the 11 of the Pharisees. This is mostly a recap of what we've already covered. So we'll skip over that and come down to the section on page 54 about the healing of the blind man at Bethsaida. So this, again, Bethsaida, one of the 3 towns there, Capernaum, Bethsaida, Chorazin. So picking up the story then in Mark 8 in verse 22, then he came to Bethsaida, and they brought a blind man to him and begged him to touch him. So he took the blind man by the hand and led him out of the town. And when he had spit on his eyes and put his hands on him, he asked him if he saw anything. So here we've seen Jesus do a number of different things with healing. We've seen him heal long distance with a nobleman's son when Jesus is in Cana and the nobleman's son is down in Capernaum, distance of 18 to 20 miles, something like that. We've seen him lay hands on people. We've heard him just say, be healed, like the man in the synagogue said, stretch out your hand. And the man does, and his hand is healed. We've seen the woman healed by touching the hem of Jesus' garment. So here we see Jesus doing something a bit different with healing. Again, he does it a number of different ways. But this is a bit different. He takes the blind man by the hand and spits on his eyes. I'm not sure if that means spitting directly in his eyes or spitting on his hands and putting it on eyes. It does say he put his hands on him. And he asks him if he sees anything. And verse 24, the man looked up and said, I see men like trees walking. And this sounds utterly bizarre to us, but think about something. You know, seeing, the act of seeing involves 2 things. It involves our eyes actually taking in the images and the receptor cones and rods and so on at the back of the eyes that receive that light coming through our eyes, but then the brain has to process what it is seeing. And that involves the brain, not the eyes. It's a very, very different process that takes place here. So this man sees these shapes of men like trees walking. He doesn't. What's going on here is, as best I can tell, is he's seeing these things, but his brain just doesn't know how to process it because the man's been blind since birth. He doesn't. He can't figure out what this is. He suddenly sees, but doesn't know what to do with it. And I think this is reflected in the next verse, verse 25. Then Jesus put his hands on his eyes again and made him look up. And he was restored and saw everyone clearly. So this seems to describe a two-stage healing process with this individual. That first, the man Jesus restores the man's eyesight. So his eyes are healed. And they now work, but since the man has been blind for so long, probably since birth, that his brain can't process what he's seeing. He can't distinguish what a human being is. He's never seen a human being before. He's never seen a tree before. So he sees these things and can't distinguish that. So it seems like Jesus heals the eyes first, and then in a second phase, heals the man's brain or gives the man's brain the ability to process what are you seeing there and to understand that. And verse 26, then Jesus sent him away to his house, saying, neither go into the town nor tell anyone in the town. So again, Jesus tells this man that he's healed of blindness not to spread it around. Again, this is at Bethsaida and near where not too many years after this zealot presence will grow very strong. Now we come to another section, bottom of page 54. As we talked about earlier with Tyre and Sidon, this is the first recorded case we have of Jesus going there. Now he goes to another area that I can't say dogmatically he's never been there before, but there's no record of it. And it seems notable that he probably would have had he gone there earlier. So he goes north from the area of Sea of Galilee, roughly 25, 30 miles to Caesarea Philippi up here. It's just further up the Jordan River Valley, and this area is actually the source of the headwaters for one of the sources for the headwaters, the Jordan River. This is an interesting location. It is the Philip. Yesterday we talked about John the Baptizer and Herod Antipas marrying Philip's wife, Herodias, and how she requested that John the Baptist's head be brought on a platter. Caesarea Philippi, this is where this Philip lives. This is his city. It's a Greco-Roman city. It's named after him, Philip, and Caesar, the Roman Caesar. So Caesarea Philippi, that's where the name comes from. It was founded originally many centuries earlier, and here's a depiction of this. It was famous as a shrine, a place of worship for the fertility god Pan, P-A-N. You may have heard of this individual before. This is a reconstruction based on archaeological reconstruction, several temples to Pan and several caves. And you'll notice these niches in the walls. That's where they would put little statues of the gods and goddesses there. And one of these shrines had actually it's this one over here. The back of the temple opened into a cave. And so here is the god Pan, half human, half goat, right here. This is what he looks like. You may have seen statues or depictions of him previously. So this is, again, one of the sources of the Jordan River with a large spring that flowed out of the mountainside, out of this cave, became the headwaters of the Jordan River. So this is what it looked like at the time of Jesus Christ, when Jesus is visiting here. It's been famous for pagan worship for many, many centuries there. And here's what it looks like today. Here's a big cave. Here's some of the niches carved into the cliff face there that you can see today, and you can see the waters flowing out. This is the beginnings of the Jordan River. This is near the base of Mount Hermon, very near the Golan Heights that were fought over in the 67 War and so on. So this is the location of it. This cave opening is considerably larger today because a number of years ago there was an earthquake and part of the entrance to the cave collapsed and made a bigger opening there. So this cave was, and this is how this came to be a place of worship for Pan. Caves in that time were thought to be entrances to the underworld, and that there were other gods and goddesses who lived underground. Pan was one of these gods. And they thought, this is going back to Greek times, they believed that Pan lived underground. And it gets into the same thing with other pagan gods like Tammuz and so on, that they either went underground in the fall, and thus the days got shorter and darker and colder and all of this, and they stayed underground in the winter, and then they reemerged in the spring and brought forth more sunshine, longer days, the greenery, crop, new baby animals, all of this. So this is all tied in with fertility gods and goddesses, which Pan is. Today, incidentally, this area is called Banias, B-A-N-I-A-S, and that's a corruption of Panias, Pan, Panias, which was the ancient Greek name for this area. So Banias, Panias. And so it's still reflected in the name of the place today. So this cave actually plays into what we will read next. This is, again, why it's important to understand your geography, where these events are taking place. So now with that background, let's pick up the story. So Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, which is what we just saw. Incidentally, the area, let me back up a little bit. The area all around this is covered with ruins of the city of Caesarea Philippi, all around there. And you go up there and you can see some of the ruins of the temples, the platforms, and so on. Therefore this. So he came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, and he asked his disciples, saying, "Who do men say that I, the Son of Man, am?" So they said, "Some say John the Baptizer, some Elijah, and others Jeremiah, or one of the prophets." And Jesus said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" Simon Peter answered and said, "You're the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus answered and said to him, "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, Simon son of Jonah," or John, "for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I also say to you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades," or the grave, the underworld, "shall not prevail against it. And I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven." So here we have what the Catholic Church proclaims as Jesus giving the authority to Peter to become the first pope and to become the head of the church. Is that what is going on? If you ever go to the Vatican or around Rome, you'll see symbols of Peter holding keys based on this verse. "I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven." So Catholic Church says this is where Jesus gave Peter all of this authority to do these things, to be the pope, and to start the line of succession of the popes and all of this. So they all base it on what we read here. But what is really going on? This is why we need to look closely and understand the background. So as Jesus said these words at Caesarea Philippi, the most prominent feature around this town is this big, huge cliff. And give some idea of the sense of scale. This niche is about the size of a human being. So here's this massive cliff. It's got roughly 100 feet high, something like that. the whole town is oriented toward this huge, massive cliff. They're looming over everything. So what is going on here? If you do understand the background, it's perfectly clear what Jesus says. But if you don't understand it and you take it out of context, this is what the Catholic Church does with their beliefs. So Jesus uses a play on words here. He says, I also say that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of the grave shall not prevail against it. So if you just look at that at face value, you can say, well, yeah, maybe they're right about that. However, again, Jesus uses a play on words. Peter, in Greek, is Petros, which means a small rock or a pebble. You might think of a piece of gravel, something about the size of your fingertips, something like that. That's what it means in the Greek, a small rock or a pebble. However, Jesus says, you are Petros, you pebble, on this rock, and he uses a very different Greek word here. The rock here he uses is Petra. Petra, which means a huge rock or a cliff. Many of you probably heard of Petra over in Jordan. Petra is an area of huge cliffs with buildings carved into the cliffs. They are so big. Comes from it's the exact same Greek word here. Petros, you are Petros, you are the pebble, but on this huge cliff, this massive rock, I will build my church. Jesus isn't equating the two together. He's actually making a statement that they are distinctively different. So it means nothing like what the Catholic Church says that it means. The Greek actually disproves this view, this interpretation of events, and shows that Jesus is not talking about building the church on Peter. He actually says that he is building the church on himself. Because who is the rock? The rock is Jesus Christ. And he's the one on whom the church is built, not on one individual. So, clear to everybody on that. Yes, Charlie. Yeah.
So Jesus is saying he's going to build his church on top of that rock, kind of showing that he has the authority and he's going to take over that paganism. Is pretty much what he's saying? Or is he saying he's that rock? Or is it both?
Actually, it's both. I'll get to the second part of that here next. I want to make sure this is clear to everybody first. So yeah, who is the foundation of the church? Have one of our hymns about that. The church's one foundation is Jesus Christ our Lord. So, and that's true. He is the rock on which the church is built. He's the one who founded it and builds it. And again, you know, I talked earlier about tekton, the word that is translated carpenter, but means builder or stonemason. Here's another indication of that. Actually, I hadn't picked up on this before, but yeah, he's building on a stone foundation, building his church on a stone foundation. Okay, clear to everybody. We have any former Catholics in here, by the way? Yeah, so you're probably familiar with that teaching. And again, this is what it's based on. So we do need to understand the languages that are used here. Okay, now let's get to the second part of that Charlie brought up here. So, okay, let me catch up with our notes. So he also says something interesting here, that the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. Hades is obviously a Greek word too. It's not Hebrew. Let's see. I talked a number of classes ago about Alexander the Great had conquered this area and the influence of Hellenism. And this is one of the leftover Greek ideas that comes from Alexander the Great and the Greek philosophers and Greek religion and all of that. And that was their concept of and the grave. Of course, they believe in the immortality of the soul, so you either go to heaven, hell, Hades when you die. Hades being the underworld, where people lived in kind of a shadowy, semi-physical, semi-spirit existence. There was the Greek concept, and some of this had bled over into Jewish belief and ideas too. We see this pop up from time to time in the New Testament. This also, yeah, Hades is often used of the grave. Just somebody goes when they die. You go to the grave, you're buried, that's where you are. But notice, it says, the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. So this also is a reference to the geography and this cave, because again, this cave is viewed as an entrance to where? To the underworld. Some of these gods and goddesses live, like Pan, but also where the underworld is, according to the Greeks, where these dead people live, this kind of shadowy existence there. So this cave is thought to be an entrance into this area, not just this cave, but other major caves in the ancient world there. So this was viewed as a gate, a doorway, an entrance to Hades or hell, place of the dead. So when Jesus says, as we were just reading here, the gates of Hades or the grave shall not prevail against the church, we've actually kind of had that backwards, thinking that death is attacking the church, death or the grave is representative of death, is attacking the church. But actually it's the other way around, because a gate doesn't attack anything. You attack the gates. The gates don't do the attacking. It's the other way around. To understand that, you read many times in the Bible about city walls and gates and so on. And here's an illustration of an ancient city, and built on a hill with walls all around it, and the city gates. This one actually has two gates. They are the weak points of a city, because it's very difficult to break through the wall. So most attacks would be against the gates. The walls are made out of brick or mud brick or stone or clay, things like that. So it's very hard to fight your way through those. But gates, you can set fire to. You can batter them down. So they are the weak points. So when Jesus talks about the gates, everybody understood what he would have been talking about, because when an army attacks a city, they go for the gates. That's the weakest point in the defenses. So what he is saying is that he's not talking about the gates of hell attacking the church, but the church attacking Satan's kingdom. Because, again, this underworld is Satan's kingdom. That's these weird, evil fertility gods and goddesses and all of that. It's the spiritual forces that control this world. Again, city gates were the weak point, because they're made of wood while the city walls are made of stone or brick. So it's actually the opposite. What Jesus Christ says here is the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it, is that the church is on the offensive attacking Satan's kingdom. That's the point. That's what our job is, to point out who the God of this age is, and that this is not God's world. This is Satan's world. He's the one in charge. He's the one who has blinded, deceived the whole world. And the church's mission is to proclaim the good news of a different kingdom and a different God, and of Jesus Christ coming to establish the kingdom of God on this earth, and how we can be a part of it. Clear to everybody? Any questions about that? Again, you got to know the context, got to know the geography, got to know, in some cases, the meanings of these words to help us better understand. All clear? Okay, let's see. We have just a couple of minutes to the break. Let's go ahead and cover this next part very quickly then. Let's see. Yeah, verse 20, wrapping up this particular section. Then he commanded his disciples that they should tell no one that he was Jesus the Christ. So again, tells him to keep it quiet, because the time is growing closer and he has to be careful that things not move too quickly and that he end up dying at a different time than the way he has to die prophetically. Verse 21, continuing, from that time, Jesus began to show to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and scribes, and be killed and be raised the third day. Then Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, "Far be it from you, Lord, this shall not happen to you." But Jesus turned and said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan. You are an offense to me, for you are not mindful of the things of God, but the things of men." And when Jesus says, "Get behind me, Satan," he's not saying Peter is literally Satan, but Peter has allowed his thinking to get off Christ's real mission, which granted Peter doesn't fully understand, nor do any of them fully understand yet, but he's being influenced by Satan and trying to thwart inadvertently God's plan here without really knowing it. Continuing, verse 24, then Jesus said to his disciples, if anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. And what he's referring to is what is going to happen to him. And I talked about this a day or two ago, that a condemned prisoner, and here's an illustration of it, would take the beam, the cross piece, and would carry that out to his place of crucifixion. And again, that was part of making the person an example. So when Christ talks about taking up your cross and follow me, he's not talking about this giant telephone pole beam that you see in the movies and so on. He's talking about a cross beam or cross piece like this. And then he goes on to say, for whoever desires to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what profit is it to a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? Or what will a man give in exchange for his soul? So again, this is repeating what we covered earlier about persecution and martyrdom, that if we try to save our lives by denying Christ or denying God and his way of life, that we end up losing eternal life. But if we are willing to lose our lives in persecution, then we stand to gain a much greater reward, which is eternal life. Okay, we'll take a break there for 10 minutes.